Thank you very much. It is actually quite a good election to put a bet on. Because normally the bookies have got a fairly good idea what's going to happen, and they fix the odds so that they're going to do very well out of view. The bookies are going to be a bit more frightened this year because it is unpredictable. I'm not going to talk all about elections, you'll be glad to know, because I've got a bit bored of this election already, but I'll start to give you a bit about that. I am angry about one thing to do with the election, and so I'd ask you to do one thing for me, if you can. It's not about the fact that Britain's going backwards in many ways, or the poor are getting poorer, we're getting more servants, and NHS is being privatised, all those kind of things. You could get angry about that. But what I'm angry about is the BBC, and the BBC have gone back in time to pre-1960, and they're using these kind of maps again. So when you see the BBC election maps, you'll see that they're normal maps of the country, and they're all blue, because that's what an election map looks like if you think that mountains and sheep are very important. I have a conspiracy theory. The BBC are very afraid for their licence fee, and so they are reverting to these kind of graphics to try to keep the coalition happy, particularly Danny Alexander up here. It's going to be interesting, actually, when the SNP do rather well, whether the BBC then switch their mapping. Anyway, you may have seen these. These are different ways of drawing election results. These are the 2010 elections looked at in different ways, and it was very, very close. That's zooming in, and the reason to zoom in, here's London, here's Birmingham, is that the purple constituencies, these ones here, this is along the East Coast, the purple ones are the ones that the Conservatives won from Labour last time. They're the marginals. And so the battle, if you like, is being fought in these particular areas. Most of you don't matter. Most of you will be living in constituencies where your vote really isn't going to influence the outcome. You're not in a marginal seat. For those of you who are, you'll already have noticed just how much attention you're getting. If you were living in Oxford in 2010, you lived in Oxford West, you would have received 40 pieces of election literature from the Conservative candidate last time, who claims to have mailed out 1 million pieces and who just won by 180-odd votes. If you're in Oxford East, you don't get that many because it's a fairly marginal but fairly safe Labour seat. For my friends from Sheffield Hallam up there, things are changing. Sheffield Hallam ought to be a safe seat, but it may well not be. ONS are doing better than the BBC. If you want to see some of these maps, they're up on the ONS website. They've looked at a lot of census data by them, so that you're not looking at sheep and mountains, you're actually looking at people. And the pictures are very, very different. Okay, a bit about the last election and what may happen this time. People forget that the British general election is done by first past the post. So although the polls are very interesting, the polls do not determine who is going to get the most seats. They don't determine who's going to win in any way, because it matters where you get the seats. Between 2001 and 2010, the Conservative Party became more popular. But they became more popular here. This is South West London, Surrey, the home counties, and more popular here, up in Essex. This was very, very bad news for the Conservative Party, because these are areas of the country which they already held, they already won. Becoming more popular, seeing your vote share rise in places where you already hold members of Parliament, is pointless when it comes to winning an election. And the geography to what's going on is often ignored by national politicians. This is the vote distribution in 2010. Again, you'll see the highest Conservative vote down in Surrey, and high in the home counties round about London, high in North Yorkshire, but low in the urban areas of the rest of England and very low in Wales and Scotland. And this is what happens when those votes are turned into seats, and it sharpens everything up. Slight advantage in the votes and you win all the seats in an area. This is the most important slide I have to show you in terms of elections. It looks at the pattern all the way from the 1918 Kharki election through to 2010. And the figure which is being plotted is the number or the proportion of Conservative voters you would have had to move across the country if you were to get a completely even distribution of Conservative voters. So it isn't how many votes they get, it's how segregated Conservative voters are. Conservative voters were very segregated around about 1918 and in the early 1920s. And then the Conservative vote rose in areas where they were not popular, fell in areas where they were popular, became much more evenly spread across the country. Sometimes your vote can be too evenly spread across the country. The Green Party have a vote which is too evenly spread across the country. They only win one constituency. If they're lucky, they might pick up another one or two. Sometimes it's very good to have a concentrated vote. The SNP vote, obviously, is concentrated in Scotland. If you could imagine the SNP were a national party rather than just a Scottish party, and you spread that vote across the whole of the UK, they wouldn't win any seats. So you need a degree of concentration to win seats, but you don't want too much concentration, otherwise you're wasting votes. Since 1974-1979, at every election, the concentration of the Conservative vote has gone higher and higher and higher. So places like here in Manchester, you're getting fewer and fewer Conservative voters, other than down in George Osborne's constituency. Down in the South East, you're getting more and more and more Conservative voters. They're corralling together. I've recently moved from Sheffield, where it was impossible to actually find a Conservative voter in Sheffield. There are no local councillors at all who are Conservative in Sheffield. To Oxford and Oxfordshire, and when I go out of Oxford and into Oxfordshire, you know that the vast majority of people you're bumping into are Conservative voters. It's a very segregated country. The interesting thing here is that when that segregation index rose to 210, it had got to such an extent that even though the Conservatives improved their poll rating nationally, they couldn't win enough members of Parliament to form a government. Now, if that carries on rising again, and this has been a long-term trend since the 1970s, if the segregation carries on rising, then the Conservatives are not going to get an outright majority, even if, and at the moment they're not looking like they're going to, but even if they were to see a rise in the polls. So I think you really should be looking at a possibility of a hung parliament. There's nothing exciting to say about that. Although it is interesting, in that for decades people thought a hung parliament was almost impossible. And now they think that anything other than a hung parliament is almost impossible. Now, if you remember this graph, I'll show you another graph that looks very much like it in a couple of slides forward. But it's a U-shaped graph. There's the polls up to December. At this point, UKIP were taken out of the other group, so the others didn't go down. There's UKIP, there's the others. Here's the two main parties coming down. They're neck and neck at the moment, or if you read your Guardian yesterday, the Guardian are claiming Labour have surged ahead, but it only takes a couple of stories and they'll be back down again, and so on. I recently saw the polling for students, and the polling for students is really interesting. A few weeks ago, for the first time ever, more students say they're going to vote Green than Conservative. That's the first time that's ever happened. And student votes are particularly concentrated. If the Green Party were clever, and if university students were clever, they would get together, because university students could hand the Green Party constituencies. But it's very hard for a political party to appeal to all students. Okay, this is a graph I wanted you to look at to remember with that polarisation of the votes. This is the income share of the best off 1% in a series of countries over time. All rich countries were very unequal about 100 years ago. They all had a small group who were rich, a large group who were poor. Everywhere, equality rose from the First World War through to the 1970s. But then, after the 1970s, different countries went in different directions. The United States became incredibly unequal. It's the most unequal large country in the rich world. But the most interesting country was the UK. When I was a child, the UK was the second most equitable country of these six, in fact, the second most equitable in all of Europe after Sweden. And then inequalities rose in the 1980s and in the 1990s and the 2000s for the UK to become the most economically unequal country in Western Europe, probably in all of Europe. We hopped over country after country after country. Our 1% now take about 15% of all income. Our best off 1% pay 33% of all income tax because they pay themselves so much and because so many other people have so low incomes they can't possibly pay income tax. And there are very different possibilities. In the Netherlands, the best off 1% take half as much. In Switzerland, the best off 1% take half as much. We are an outlier. This is the most complicated graph I'm going to show you. In fact, I think it's the last graph. But I think it matters. It's very geographical because we tend not to compare ourselves to other countries as much as I wish we would do. We are the little blue dots here. And this is the public spending of Britain as a share of GDP. So way back 2002, 2003, 2004, our public spending was under 40% of GDP. It rose. This is a terrible profligate increase of spending of the Labour government. You see it there? It was very, very bad. It was very naughty, I think. I actually think it was naughty because it was the cost of an overseas war. If you take the cost of the war out, we wouldn't have had an increase of spending. Anyway, there we are. Ireland spends much less, the USA spends less. Most European countries spend and tax much more. And then every country does this. That's the bailout. That's when we came very close to the cash points not working. And here's our plan. And our plan is to come down to here by this year. And they've almost hit it. To spend a lower proportion of our GDP on public services than any other major country in Europe and less than the United States. And our plan going forward to 2019 is to go down to here. But if you vote Labour, we'll be here. If you vote Conservative, we'll be here. And that's the parameters of our politics. Greens, you know, tiny bit up. SNP, tiny bit up. UKIP, way down there, maybe. And I just think we need to put things into an international perspective for students and at school and so on. Otherwise, you can grow up thinking that this is all that's possible. This is the only way things can be. You know, left and right only exist within this spectrum. And this is the only sensible area to be in. Anything else is madness. Whereas, in fact, anything else is normal in the rest of the world, and we are the weird ones. I'm now going to show you a series of maps of Europe, and then I'm going to zoom out to the world, because I think there's a wider politics that's worth looking at. These are these cartograms shown of Europe, but now showing you things like the rise in unemployment since the Great Recession hit. That's what happens to Spain. It's even worse in Greece because Greece has a smaller population, and this is just showing you the absolute numbers of unemployed. We didn't do well, but you have to remember that things like unemployment are not a simple statistic. It's not hard to get your unemployment level really low. All you need to do is reduce benefits. If you get benefits really, really low so people can't live off them, they'll do any job. And that's part of what's happened in the UK. So we have a huge number of people on 0 hours contract, part-time work they don't want to be doing. People doing two or three jobs. We have more jobs than we've ever had before. It's not necessarily a good thing to have more jobs than you've ever had before. Just going to show you how we fit into the European Parliament in terms of politics. In Europe, there are two major groups. There's a conservative group and a socialist group, coloured conveniently blue and red. And that's the current distribution of seats in the European Parliament. That's how many seats we held in the Conservative group. See, we're there. And again, these things are generally not known well enough. Our Conservative Party used to be a member of this group for many, many years. It chose to leave the group, so we no longer have any MPs in the Conservative group in Europe. And the Conservative group is pretty well spread out across the whole of Europe. Instead, our Conservative Party have joined a new group, created a new group with some people from some very odd parties in Eastern Europe, to the right of European Conservatives. So that's where our Conservative Party now fits. Here's our Liberals. We don't have many Liberals, but they hold a balance of power, so they're in government. And that's what the distribution of Liberal votes looks like across the whole of Europe. So there are many more Liberals across Europe than there are Liberals that you'll find in the UK. European Freedom and Direct Democracy parties. This is UKIP, and their friends in Italy. So at least the Italians have some people like UKIP as well. I'm afraid I managed to miss out the Labour one, but here's a green one. So we're still very young when it comes to a green party. This is what the distribution of green votes looks like across the whole of Europe. And these are our green votes at European elections, when the Greens do best. And they're still pretty low. Remarkably good in Greece. Or they were. Yeah. If you really want an example of things getting very exciting and very frightening, looking at voting in Greece shows you the kind of things that could happen. For years at Sheffield, I was involved in a field trip where we'd take undergraduates to Athens. And for years and years, this really was just a party. They weren't learning very much. And we had to give them instructions such as, please dress well because you'll look too scruffy compared to the locals. And then the crisis hit. And suddenly, going on that field trip from the University of Sheffield to Athens for a week, they learned more in a week in Athens, I think, than they learned in 3 years in Sheffield, just by seeing what can happen to a country when the cash points really do run out, or when everything begins to end. And in Greece, as you'll know, the voting has shifted wildly. The Greek people have tried one party after another after another. Across all of Europe, in fact, across all the world, when the crisis hit, voters tended to vote out of power whoever was in power at the time of the crisis. Then they vote those people out of power and they can't solve the problem. Greece has currently voted for Syriza, so it has a Syriza majority with a tiny coalition partner. If Syriza fail, the next option the Greeks have is to vote for Golden Dawn, who are a fascist party. And that isn't, I think, recognised enough in terms of what may happen next in Greece if things fail. So let's go out of Europe and out of the UK and just talk about wider politics and other things that really matter. Because British politics can be a huge turn-off to young people. It's a massive turn-off since they were lied to in the last election. And the levels of cynicism amongst the young are at an all-time high, and you can't really blame them for doing it. So what I'm going to show you now are a series of world pictures. You can find most of these on the Views of the World website by Ben Hennig, and they're produced by Ben Hennig. If you can't find them there, send Ben an email and tell him to get on and produce that world atlas he should be doing. But what I'll do is I'll show you these pictures, but I'll try to give you a political slant to them as a possible way of making these kind of issues more interested to geographers and geography students, so they can see a wider politics rather than their local parochial one. So here's the world shown by population. It's a gridded cartogram. So Chongqing is here, probably the biggest city in China. Here's India. We are just 1% of the world's people, slightly less than 1%. We only have 0.5% of the world's children. If we manage to stop immigration, we could get that down to 0.25% of the world's children, while still having 1% of the world's old people. And that would be fun. I'm used to this map, so sorry for zooming through it, but I want to leave you time for questions. So I'm going to just show you a lot very quickly. But I think if you look at the world this way, you begin to get a different view of the planet and of people, and people become less scary. You're looking at 7.2 billion people here. We are a large chunk of Europe. We're not insignificant, but Europe is a continent of cities. Here's London, here's Manchester, here's Paris, here's Madrid. When I took the train yesterday, in my mind, I spent ages doing this tiny little journey here, and then we zip through this bit here, zip through this bit here, and then ages doing this bit here before I got here. And I now see the country like this. These are the kind of things that you can do with these maps. This is taking the regions of England and the boroughs of London and drawing each of them according to the amount of transactions in residential property each year. So what you're seeing is the housing bubble growing up until the crash of 2007, and then you're seeing the new housing bubble growing up to the crash of, you pick your date. My favourite date at the moment is the day after the election. Well, why does the Chancellor need to keep house prices high after he's maximised his votes? The other depressing thing, if you look, this is the amount of money being spent on houses every year, so it's billions. If you take 2 noughts off that, you can see how much money estate agents make each year. It's absolutely huge. Here's Ben's effort at trying to work out overseas money, hidden money, money put into tax havens. We are significant in this. There is a lot of money in the world. A huge amount. I was watching the news about those people, all those boxes in, where is it? Down in London somewhere? Hatton, yeah? Yeah. I wonder how many are going to admit to how much they actually had in those boxes. Anyway, let's zoom through issues. Nuclear power. You can use these maps to look at things like nuclear power stations. Here are Britain's nuclear power stations. Here are the exclusion zones if something were to go wrong in them. You'll notice that we are on the edge of one. If I change it from this map to this map, they stop being circles, they become a different shape, and you suddenly see that this area isn't in... in theory, wouldn't have a problem if we had a problem in one of our nuclear power stations. Whereas here, we would. So it isn't that we build nuclear power stations to avoid urban areas, we build them to avoid particular urban areas. Ben's now done this for the whole of Europe, because you might think this is coincident, but you find the same thing in France with Paris, and the same thing in Germany with Berlin and Bonn. Wherever politicians work, they don't cite a nuclear power station. A more complicated map of Germany, just to show the kind of things you can do here. The blue areas are declining population. So eastern Germany, but also the Ruhr. Like most of Europe, population levels in Germany are declining. All of Europe, people are having fewer than 2 children per couple. In some parts of Europe, it's 1.3, 1.1 children. This is a continent which is shrinking. Population change in the last 25 years. The red areas are areas that are still rising quite rapidly in population. There are not many red areas. They tend to be areas where life is tricky. So the Yemen, which again was in the news today, parts of West Africa, Central Africa. In China, you see rapid population growth in the cities, Chongqing, and down on the coast. But equally, you see these blue areas, which are population decline, as rural areas are depopulating from China. And our continent is shrinking. The fastest declines are in Eastern Europe. What we talk about as immigration is actually population decline for Eastern Europe, and is the only reason why our population is not declining, why we're still this orange colour, because people are moving from here to here. They're moving because of where the concentrations of wealth are in the world. This is an attempt to look at where the money is, not by country, but by very small area. Here's Tokyo. You see the money is beginning to move around in a different way than before. There's been the most incredible changes since 2008 in terms of GDP and wealth worldwide that we still haven't caught up with. But I have too many maps to show you, so I'm going to click through them faster. Apologies to physical geographers. I've always been completely useless at physical geography. But you can map some of these things on to human geography maps. And in many cases, it is useful to do that. Earthquakes. Geographers always like earthquakes. But this is earthquakes. Many thousands of earthquakes all put together over people. So it gets you to concentrate on where earthquakes happen, where they may affect people. And suddenly the south of Europe is highlighted. Volcanoes. Geographers like volcanoes even more than earthquakes. And again, just a different way of looking and worrying about which volcanoes matter and which don't, may not matter as much. There's Iceland, it's my favourite. Tropical storms, again. And of course the link from this and politics is climate change. It's the increase in the frequency of tropical storms and who will be affected. Or the increase in cooling, in colder winters, or changes to the rainfall. So here's rainfall moving across the planet month by month. So you can see the monsoons moving across the population. It's no longer moving across the land, but across the population. And for me, when you begin to see images like this, and you do it over people, you begin to think of humanity as a single collection of people, not as a collection of people sorted out by different countries in different states. Okay, we're now going to warp the map even further. So if you were losing me before, you're definitely going to be lost now. What this next animation does is make the area of each cell proportional to the amount of rainfall that's falling on it that month in the world. So it's no longer population, we're just looking at rainfall. And you can kind of see, I don't know, a kind of heartbeat effect going across the planet as the rains move around. And these are the kind of things that are going to matter more and more in the future, because we're going to start running out of water in some areas, and the fact that we are using goods produced in other countries that require their water to produce will become politically more and more important. There's population growth looked at in a different way. So we have little bit of growth in the south of England from immigration. I mean, if you just look at that size of that little bump and compare it to the population growth of the whole world, the arguments in Britain about there being too many people compared to what's happening in India, what's happening in China, I personally think this isn't an argument about too many people. I think what's happening in Britain is that people are confusing their drop in living standards and the fact they're finding it harder to house themselves and they're finding it harder to school their children and so on, harder to get a secure job. And they're assuming that the reasons for all of that are immigration. And that isn't the reasons for why that is happening. Here's population decline. You'll notice that we're bigger here. We have more areas which are declining in population than are actually growing, because the people who are coming to the southeast of England and particularly to London, a few to the east. But the decline in China is massive, just as the increase in other parts of China is massive. This animation goes far too fast, but if any of you are fascinated by China, Ben has these slides up on the Views of the World website, so you can look at them in detail. Chinese human geography is just staggering. over what's currently happening in that continent. And China's population is about to start declining quite rapidly. That's what happens if you have a one-child policy for that length of time. Other ways of looking at the world. Here's our pasture land. Here's the crop lands of the world. Another way of looking at cropland. And then water insecurity on top of croplands. Because you've got to feed 7.2 billion people. 8 billion people within another 12 years. I suspect never more than 9 billion people. The UN currently say 11 billion people by 2100. These are the kind of political issues that really matter. These are the ones that are going to affect young people's future. Far, far more than who happens to win in the next election. And you can do the same thing with a whole different set of measures of water insecurity in the world. And then you can begin to look at things very differently. So I'm going to look at wilderness. This is turning the whole map upside down. It's making areas large if they're a long way away for people. So if you want to get away from people, where do you need to go? It makes more sense, I think, to do it for Britain. So if you're planning your summer holidays, in fact, you can always see why Germans go to Scotland, I think, because there's less solitude in Germany. Let's go skip that one. So my argument is that May the 7th really is a blip. I mean, it is going to be an exciting election. It does matter. It will change what happens. The NHS will privatise faster if people vote one way than the other. We could get a referendum on Europe, depending on how people vote. If you really want to see rapid population decline in the UK, all you need to do is to vote to get a referendum on Europe and then watch all the people leave who come. These are young, productive people with degrees. And just watch what happens to the British economy then, which would make the world a more equal place if it became poorer. And this is why I think, you know, it's so easy to get cynical about British politics, which is why looking at worldwide issues, I think, helps escape from the cynicism. Here's a little image of all the countries of the world drawn in this particular way. That's why you need to email Ben and tell him to get that atlas made. Here's the population centre of the world. When you draw the lines on top of people. It's here. Ben and I thought of buying this village. Which is just here on this map in the middle. Sadly, you could actually buy it. We then suddenly realised that, of course, the population centre moves around, so it would be fairly pointless buying it. And I'll just end with some images of ecological footprint for you. This is how many planets we would need if people behave like they behave in all these countries. If they behave like we behave here, we need about 3 planets. If we behave like citizens of the United States, we need 4 planets. Most of the world is consuming and polluting far less. But if they behave like us and they copy us, then we're done for. If you spread it over people, it doesn't look quite so bad, because the majority of the world where people are consuming and polluting less is larger by population. But if you spread it over GDP, it begins to look much worse. And just a few more for you. This is the world shaped by air flights going overhead. So Russia gets a bit bigger. This one. This is the world shaped by GDP. And my point about, you know, if you're trying to make the world a fairer place, actually engineering an economic crash for the UK would move towards that. It's not what I would desire, but for the last 100 years, this country has slowly been becoming slightly more normal. We were the richest place on the planet 100 years ago, so when you walk around Manchester and you look at all those warehouses and so on, you're looking at the city that was the first industrialised American city built. And what we've been doing since 1918 is slowly and painfully learning what it's like to become a normal European country. And we're not very good at this. And a lot of this election is about that. Lastly, just some images of the continents, and then I'll end so that you can ask me some questions. North America, the colours are altitude. So this is Mexico. Most North Americans who are living at altitude are living down in Mexico. Mexico is very large, Canada is very small, and the US is a sea of cities. South America is even more urbanised now. Those of you who like Australia and New Zealand, they are minnows in the area that they are in. Here's East Asia. There are always arguments amongst geographers about which is the largest city. And the nice things about these maps is that you can just look at them and go, actually, that is a very large city. Without worrying about the fact that it still has paddy fields in the middle of it. Again, I just like this animation, so I'm showing you twice. South Asia, one of the areas still growing rapidly in population. If China was going to balance its aging, the easiest way to do it would be to import people from here to here. Not easy politically, but it would help a lot worldwide. Here's the Middle East, as you've never seen it before. And one of the few places where people are still having 5 or 6 surviving children per woman. Hopefully that will decline rapidly. It will not decline if there's continuous war in that part of the Middle East. Here's the African continent, looked at in a different way. Here's where the elections were held recently in Nigeria. This is why they matter, because it's so many people. Russia is now largely Moscow. And is shrinking rapidly, and really is a country that's finding it very hard to adapt to its changing status in the world. And lastly, here we are back in Europe. And I don't think the Sun are going to do this headline that I'd like them to do. But you never know. You never know, they might do it. Thank you very much for your attention, and please think of some questions to ask me.
A blip. Never have I been to a keynote address about a blip and beheld so transfixed, so thank you very much indeed. We have got time for some questions if anyone has a question for Danny. Yes.
Danny, can we go back to your most important slide, if that's possible?
Actually, the easy way to do it is this way. You mean the graph?
Yeah, and I'll start with a question.
Yeah.
I'm just curious as to perhaps a bit more on the explanation for that trend you identify. I've been in the US for a number of years, and in the US there's a sort of a parallel trend of people dividing themselves into red and blue states, and also red and blue neighbourhoods, not just in terms of identifying themselves by political party, but also by ethnicity as well. So there's an increasing fragmentation, and people wanting to live with like-minded, so that people are looking for identities and choosing to live in neighbourhoods with like-minded people. So there's a strong trend
Yeah. I mean, this decline is part of the era of the rise of the Labour Party, which was a party that came out of nothing, but also the Home Rule debate about Ireland was going away, and it was Conservatives and Unionist Party. But the country came together in all kinds of ways in the 20s and 30s. Half of our reduction in inequality happened before 1939. Large numbers of the very rich households had to give their country seat to the taxman, in effect, in the 1930s. It was donated to the National Trust, but it's because they couldn't. And we often forget that half of that gain we made was achieved before the Second World War, and was then. And part of that coming together as a country, we were incredibly divided. The most common job for women was to be a servant. Back here, part of that coming together of a country was a change in the Conservative Party to become a party which was much more of a one nation party and spread out across the whole country. Still a party of the better off, but the better off all over the place. The huge change was 1974. I'm wondering, how many of you got to vote in the 74 election? Okay, so it's a minority of you can remember. There were two elections in 74, February and October. And in the October of 74, the southeast of the country switched to Conservatives. They'd had enough of the miners. I think it was not coping with this slow decline of the country becoming a normal country. That wasn't enough for Labour to lose the election. Labour won the election, but the southeast switched Conservative then. The Conservative Party made Margaret Thatcher the leader the year after. So it's actually the people who changed first, then the Conservative Party. And then from that point onwards, the segregation increases as the southeast becomes more and more conservative and urban areas of the north become more and more Labour. And so that you do get this incredible polarisation that's happened between areas. If any of you live in Scotland, you'll know that things are so very, very different. They only sell 7,000 copies of The Guardian in Scotland. Right? People read different newspapers. Whereas if you're in England, you might assume that Scotland's full of Guardian readers. It's not. It's a different country. And the only way you really get to see this is if you move around the country and actually move home. So I've just gone from being a fairly mild-mannered, middle-of-the-road kind of person in Sheffield, with a lot of friends who are far more radical than me. And all I've done, I haven't changed my politics, but I am by far the most left-wing person down I know in Oxford. because I've shifted around. And it takes you some time to realise that any conversation you might have, what people's thoughts are likely to be. And without moving around, you acclimatise to it, you don't see it. And it changes how children are brought up, it changes attitudes in general. The Today programme have been doing a series of interviews with children where they've talked to school children in neighbouring constituencies, an affluent constituency. They did one up here, an affluent constituency and a poor constituency. And just hearing the children talk, and of course are reflecting what their parents and teachers tell them, is fascinating because almost none of this comes from the children. It's coming from the social environment in which they're being brought up in. And they are talking about completely different things and completely different futures. The affluent children are talking about which university they will go to. And they're all going to go to university. The poorer children are just talking about, will they get a job? Will they get a house? You know, really basic stuff.
I have a question that relates to your most complicated graph, which shows the decline of public spending in the UK. Which clearly relates to quality of life in terms of housing, the NHS, education, and so on.
Yeah.
And yet, most people, as you pointed out, believe, or a large percentage of the population, significant part of the population, are of the belief that immigration is responsible for the decline in these things.
Yeah.
Whereas if you look at this graph, it's fairly obvious that decline in public expenditure is related. Why do you think it is that more people, politicians, left-wing people, socialists, whoever, aren't pushing more the relationship of this and trying to explain the fact that actually it's not to do with immigration, it's to do with this? Because we don't hear that, do we?
No. It's tricky to do. Immigration has been the most salient issue at the last four elections, apart from 2010, when the economy just managed to beat immigration after the most almighty economic crash since 1929. So immigration really is in there in the top of people's heads. And I think it fits in, you know, what's the difference between my childhood and now? And you go, oh, in my childhood there were many more white people, there were far fewer immigrants, and we didn't have to lock our door, and my dad had a job which he kept for all his life, and they could even get a mortgage. And people fit the kind of rose-tinted, because it wasn't all great in the past, but they fit that rose-tinted difference, and then compare it, what's changed? Oh, there are new people here. It must be them. Of course, if we hadn't had the immigration, our GDP would be much, much lower, and you know, the situation would be far worse. Why? I mean, until now, politicians, a lot of them have avoided the issue. So although it was the most salient issue for voters in 97, and in 2001, 2005, politicians were avoiding talking about it, and UKIP was right that they really were avoiding it. Now you can get mugs, Labour mugs, saying we'll control immigration, which really is a switch of the Labour Party. I think it's really hard when you've had a narrative for so long which has been saying immigration is a problem, it's the immigrants who are using up the houses, it's the immigrants who are taking your school places, it's the immigrants who are taking your jobs. Turning that narrative around is very difficult. But it's, we are like the California of Europe. I mean, the interesting thing is that in each of the last three recessions before this one, we had net emigration. People left in the 80s. Do you remember Alfred Saint-Pet? He went off to Germany to find work. Same in the 90s, our population actually went down. In the 70s, the population went down, people left. This time, when you get a worldwide recession, people come, partly because there's nowhere to go to, because there aren't jobs in other places. And that happened after 1929 as well. People actually came to Britain. So I think it's partly, we haven't had a combination of economic recession and people coming in for a very long time, so that's new. But also, if you believe that it's good for the rich to get richer, and that benefits everybody because they're wealth creators and there's trickle down, but you can't sell that story because most people won't believe you anymore, but you believe it, you really think that there are some especially talented people, and if we don't let them get rich, the whole country's ruined, but you can't sell that story, then the story you tell people is, we'll make your life better by controlling immigration, because you can't sell the story you actually believe in. And I think that's led on the right of politics, and then the left of politics have just followed it rather than be brave enough to turn it round.
One quick question, colleague in the middle, and then we'll have to...
How much do you think the inequality that we have and that the previous graph, I think the one between this one and the one you showed earlier, where we've got a very high proportion of our... a very high proportion of the wealth that our 1% hold. How much do you think that's to do with the fact that so many of our voters in so many parts of the country just don't count?
Oh, yes, because we've got... In this country, there are only two political parties, and they have first-past-the-post, and most voters don't count. In fact, almost half don't even bother to vote. Here we had, until recently, only three political parties. And first past the post. In all these other countries, they have proper democracy. And there is a correlation between voting systems and equality. The more equal a country is economically, the more likely people are to have a voting system where their vote matters. But also, there's another problem or another connection between these things. People's levels of numeracy and basic understanding are much lower here. When we measure abilities in maths at age 16 to 24, they're lowest here, and in Europe, they're lowest here. Not at GCSE, at GCSE, people are very good at getting A's and B's at maths, just a few years later, because we're an exam culture, not a learning culture. He says, I know you all love exams, and there's nothing better than them. It's always good to change curriculum and introduce new ones, isn't it? But if you asked a question, do you think your children are going to get into the 1% in these different countries? The people most likely to say that their children will become rich are in the USA. And the people least likely to say that their children will become rich. And the people most likely to understand that only 1% of people can ever be in the 1% are in the most equitable country. And it is connected. We do become conditioned to be less understanding of what's going on. And if you've got to be really cynical about it, in more unequal countries, politicians who like inequality have an interest in a large bulk of the population being taught less and less of use and more of rote, so that they don't think for themselves. The danger in Britain for politicians who like that is that half our young women are now going to universities. So unless we really muck it up in universities, which we're quite capable of doing, I do not see how it is possible in this country, even with all my cynicism, that you can have half of young women and around about heading towards 40% of young men going to university, and we'll manage to fool all of them as well into thinking it's in their interest for a tiny proportion of people to become wealthier and wealthier. And if there's any problems, it's all caused by the immigrants coming in. I don't think that's possible. But we're doing a natural experiment to see whether it is possible. And if you step out and look at the world level, and if you go and spend some time in other European countries, it's more refreshing. We could head back to the past. We have an option in Britain of heading back to the levels of inequality we had around the time of the First World War. We have an option of going back to many people working in service for a small number of very wealthy people. We've got an option of going back to a largely privatised health system and to a very, very divided education system with different schools for different calibre of pupils. That's already happening at sixth form level, where academies are allowed to change their admissions policies for who they take in at 17 and 18. And we could be the example nation of the one that goes back in time. And the reason we would do it is that we're not coping with no longer being a world power. And so we become, if you like, a kind of haven for the super rich of the world. We'll have the lowest property taxes in the world. You come here, we'll take a bit of your wealth, and we'll provide you with some butlers. That's my cynical view of Plan A, or winning the global race. And it's a plan. I mean, the super rich of the world are gonna congregate somewhere. Why not let it be London? And I don't like that plan, as you can tell. But I do think that is what Plan A currently is. And a lot of what the battle in the election is about is whether to go for that plan or something else. And that's why you saw non-doms coming up yesterday, and where you'll see increasing rhetoric towards election day about the 1% and 99%. And the immigration rhetoric will change towards, are we going to be a favoured home for immigration from some of the richest people in the world who we will let in and give them some of the lowest taxes in the world, or not? And that's the kind of choice we have. Thank you very much.